Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, and this is MoneyWeb at Midday. Whether you're tuning in live or listening to the podcast, please join me as I explore the issues and ideas shaping our world with key thinkers and decision makers. So let's get started, sharp, relevant, and right to the heart of the story. Coming up on the program, FlySaf Air on its overbooking practice. We'll ask why there are so many unemployed junior doctors, major trends that shaped the Rand in 2024 and what those mean for the currency this year, and a glimmer of hope for the local manufacturing sector. It's Monday, the 13th of January. Let's start with the aviation industry, and the National Consumer Commission says it's investigating FlySaf Air for allegedly bumping a ticket-holding passenger from a flight. The airline has responded, saying it's confident its policies are compliant with the Consumer Protection Act. It goes on to say it prides itself on being transparent and consumer-focused. However, the airline is also urging the commission to conduct what it terms a fair and balanced investigation without disproportionately targeting them. Joining us now is Kirby Gordon, who is Chief Marketing Officer at the carrier. Kirby, a very warm welcome. We know that overbooking is common in the airline industry the world over, but maybe explain the mechanics. Why is this practice necessary for airlines?
Thanks, Jeremy. It's great to have the opportunity to ventilate this issue. Yes, overbooking is something that is used across the entire industry, both locally and internationally. And it's quite an important part of our business model. What it allows us to do is to exploit a degree of breakage, which means that we can ultimately keep fares slightly lower, but also allow for slightly more lenient policies when it comes to individuals that do miss their flights, and we would otherwise have to operate an aircraft with an empty seat rather than serve them again on a later flight.
So how does an airline calculate the risk of a no-show passenger when deciding to overbook? What is it's an algorithm, I imagine.
Yes, and this is a very kind of key element to the whole story. I mean, the Consumer Protection Act obviously does permit this degree of overbooking. It's a common practice within aviation, but also within hotels, etc. And what you have to do is prove that you are doing this responsibly. So we look, of course, at the number of no-shows that we get per flight, and then we take we then determine a number of overbookings that we would permit per that particular flight. And obviously, one looks to do that, you know, far below what the average number of no-shows are on that flight in order to be able to ensure and to responsibly manage that you give the opportunity to the passenger to have the best possible chance of actually getting onto that flight.
How do you decide who gets bumped off a flight if no one volunteers to step forward?
In our instance, I mean, every airline has a slightly different policy as to how they address it. In our instance, it's a sort of last come, last served approach. So ultimately, if no one voluntarily wants to get off the flight, then we use the person that checked in last.
And they've just got to live with the frustration, and the airline is prepared to take that risk.
Yes, so I mean, there is obviously compensation that is associated with it. It is something that, again, that is managed very closely through the Consumer Protection Act to ensure that you do the appropriate things. So in our instance, what we do is we offer R1,000 compensation per passenger immediately, and then we try to put them on the next available flight, be that a flight with us or through one of our reprotection agreements that we have with other airlines, to get them away as soon as we possibly can. And mostly it happens that they get away within, you know, an hour of when their original departure was. So usually it doesn't really have a particularly large impact. It is obviously very frustrating to individuals that do experience this. I'd say they are very few compared to the number of individuals that we can help through lower pricing and through genuinely missing their flights and then needing some more lenient policies to get onto the next one. So on average, if one looks at it across the world and across the history of aviation, as a business practice, it is something that helps us to thrill and accommodate more customers than it does disappoint those that are unfortunately impacted by the policy.
Nonetheless, there will still be people who are disappointed. How often do people rail against this? How many complaints do you get in an average year?
Relatively few, to be honest, Jeremy, because the reality is that it happens so infrequently. This impacts, we've done the calculation over the last 10 months, and this impacts 0.00006% of our passengers. So you can understand that it's not really a whole lot of people that are influenced by it. And usually we're able to recover the situation very quickly, as I say, getting them with that compensation onto the next available flight, which is frustrating, but never necessarily the end of the world.
How transparent is SAFAir with its customers about the possibility of overbooking when they purchase a ticket?
I would argue that we're the most transparent in the local industry. Obviously, as a result of this and the homework that we've been doing for the NCC, we've been reviewing the terms and conditions for all local airlines. And ours very clearly stipulates that we agree that we will overbook our flights to a certain extent, and that the compensation that we will offer as a result of being bumped off a flight is XYZ. It's very clear and very transparently put out there in very plain language. Of course, you see it in other terms and conditions for other airlines, but it's just generally kind of masked under the ideas of denied bookings, etc., etc. We're very frontal about it.
Has the National Consumer Commission investigation into this latest incident begun yet?
We've started our preparations. They've given us a deadline that we're working towards. So they've asked us to prepare against a certain questionnaire. So we have started and commenced with that process. And we've obviously also written to them to say, we're very happy to comply with this because we do believe that we're within the realms and the remits of what is outlined in the Consumer Protection Act. But as you mentioned before, we insist that they actually look at the industry at large. We're not lone rangers in this regard and in this practice. And so it would be unfair to disproportionately target us off the back of this particular complaint. They really need to look at the whole industry, because we believe that we're actually far more conservative than most when it comes to this practice.
You wouldn't be raising that concern unless you have worry about the way in which this investigation is going to proceed, though.
I think we've got no reason to be worried at this stage. We haven't dealt with the NCC directly before. We have, dealt with various inquiries through the likes of the Competition Commission. And generally speaking, we find these bodies to be very on the ball and to be very thorough in their investigations and very fair. I think they understand the need to balance what is important to the consumer with good business practice and with also the sort of sustainability of the businesses that they serve and investigate. So we're very confident to participate with them and very willing, and obviously to give them the benefit of the doubt in terms of a fair review.
Are there any plans to adjust your overbooking policy to better address customer concerns, or are you satisfied with the veracity of it as it exists?
As it exists in the moment, and given the statistical analysis that we've done off the back of it and obviously continue to review, the intention is to maintain it as it is. But of course, we will work with the NCC and the industry to see what the outcomes are of their particular findings, and we can take it from there.
Kirby Gordon, I must also ask you this question. Your carrier has certainly been in the news over the past couple of weeks. There was the high-profile alleged racist incident on a recent flight of yours. What's the status of that investigation? And I'm wondering to myself, as this issue still percolates, whether there are lessons that the airline has learnt about handling sensitive situations involving passengers, or are you happy with the way in which it was handled on board?
Yes, that was a deeply unfortunate incident. Obviously, it's very difficult for us to deal with this. We do deal with, the larger public, and this time of year particularly can perpetuate some rather unpleasant behavior. As the situation stands at the moment, to answer your first question as to where it is, obviously from an airline's perspective, we've done what we need to do to redress our policies and our procedures, in which there's not really much recourse that we managed to change. I mean, obviously, we have fairly little control over the behavior of customers as you fly with us, unfortunately. We've taken, the best care that we possibly can of the employees who were involved in the situation. And naturally, we have disclosed to the particular individuals that they are no longer welcome on any SAFAir flights. Everything consequent to that, with regard to her employer, the SABC, the comments that were made by the ANC, the issues that were taken to the Human Rights Commission, etc., those are all very much processes that are ongoing between herself and those the various institutions. I know as much as you do in terms of what I read in the news.
And just a final one, do you think a person like this who is showing signs of inappropriate behavior should either have been flagged at the lounge or even at the boarding gate before this even got on board?
So we do. We do frequently deny boarding, and that is also something that is stipulated in our terms and conditions if we do see somebody that is clearly intoxicated when they're boarding. Obviously, that depends entirely on their behavior at the time. So, you know, we would rely upon them showing evident signs of not being fit to fly. And that does happen from time to time. But unfortunately, in this circumstance, no one, you know, that was not evident at the time of booking or the time of boarding. And so this particular passenger was allowed on board, and it was during flight that her behaviours changed.
Kirby Gordon is the Chief Marketing Officer at SAFAIR.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Despite completing years of training and community service, around 1,800 junior doctors remain jobless, with provinces like the Eastern Cape now openly admitting they cannot provide employment for these skilled professionals. The South African Medical Association is warning of far-reaching consequences for our healthcare system. With fewer posts available, hospitals are stretched thin, overworking existing staff and compromising patient care. The association has now launched a national survey to better understand the scope of the problem and is urging government to act decisively by funding more posts and addressing the root causes of the systemic failure. More now from Dr. Ruan Boerter, chairperson of the Junior Doctors Association of South Africa. Dr. Boerter, you've reached out then to medical authorities. What are they telling you, and are you satisfied with the response?
I think we can definitely start by saying we are not satisfied with them at all. As an association, we're still waiting for a formal response from the Minister of Health. But if we look at his responses in the media on SABC and Newsroom Africa, those responses are very, very concerning. For Minister of Health to admit that there's corruption and theft in his department and then saying that's not really part of the problem is very concerning. Saying that he doesn't care about the World Health Organization's recommended ratio of 1 to 1,000 patients. So when you look at doctors, it's also very concerning. And then telling doctors to leave the country or go work in private is also very, very concerning. If we look at the provinces themselves, in the Eastern Cape, there's been a bit of engagement, but again, a lack of planning from their side with no solutions. So we've been asking them for engagement so that we can work with them on addressing this issue. We think it's a problem of planning with regards to the budget and not planning for doctors that are finishing their community service here. I think when we look at the government, when there's a problem with the South African Airways or with Eskom, they're very, very quick to get money. But now that we're struggling with a health system and a system that's failing and people that are going to be dying, they are taking their time. So definitely not satisfied with the responses or the effort that the government is making with this at all.
Now, I'm correct in saying that if you're not satisfied, if government doesn't address the issue, you want to pursue legal action. What might that entail and how likely is it?
So we definitely will be planning on taking legal action. I think we will be looking at the Health Act, where they have a responsibility to not only render health services to all, but quality health service to all. And that's definitely where the government is failing. We're still in the process of planning this and thinking exactly with our legal team how we can address this. But it is something that we are seriously considering.
You're also conducting a nationwide survey. Explain to me what the purpose of that is and what insights you're hoping to gain and how the data that you gather might then be used to influence policy, if in fact it can be.
So firstly, we just want to get the accurate statistics. So currently we are on there's a WhatsApp group that I'm part of as well with unemployed doctors in the country. And there we have 1,800 doctors on that group. But we just want to do a survey to double check those numbers and make sure that they are accurate, because end of last year, there was a meeting in the Eastern Cape where a government official told doctors that all the associations and unions are lying about doctors that are unemployed and the number of unemployed doctors. So we want to get this survey to have fixed statistics and accurate statistics that we can show to them. And I can say that survey at the moment has 1,100 responses at the moment. So almost getting very close to that number of 1,800. But we also want to gather the situation of the doctors, where they are willing to work, and especially what specialities they are considering to work in or willing to work in, but then also gathering their details so that as an association, we can also try and assist these doctors to get maybe temporary locum positions in the private sector. And that's also some of the information we are getting with this survey.
Explain to me what happens if the junior doctors who are now trained but still need to spend time in the field are not working. What does it mean in terms of their ability to operate and their careers?
So I think what's important to note is that in South Africa, doctors can only specialize in the public sector. So I can use myself as an example, someone that wants to do surgery. I have all the courses that I have to do. I've written even my first examination to go and specialize, of which there are three, but I've written the first one. But in order to continue in my career, I do need to get a medical officer post in the state to be able to specialize. And that's for all the specialities the same. There's no specialization in the private sector. So what's going to happen is doctors' careers are being brought to a halt. They can't specialize. We're going to get deliver less specialists in the country, which we also need in this country. We don't only need medical officers or GPs. We need specialists as well. And then what's probably going to happen is doctors are going to start leaving the country, and we're going to have a bigger brain drain than we have at the moment.
And just very quickly, what role then does private healthcare play in this conversation? Would it absorb some of the unemployed junior doctors, or is that a non-starter?
So some doctors can go work in private. So you can go open your own GP practice now after your community service. But that's very costly for doctors to do. And not everyone wants to be a general practitioner. Then you have the options of locuming or working in private emergency rooms. But that sector is also getting very, very saturated. And if you're 1,800 people trying to enter that sector as well, it's also very, very difficult. But it's also important to note that the government doesn't always, or the state hospitals, when looking at employing people to specialize, the time you spent in private is not viewed the same as viewing in public, which makes sense. You're allowed to do a lot more in public hospitals as a junior doctor than in private. And again, it sort of halts the progression of their career further, but there is the possibility of employment there. And that's also where, as an association in the survey, we're gathering that information to try and assist and place doctors in the few spaces that are available.
Dr. Ruanbota, thank you very much indeed. Chairperson, Junior Doctors Association of South Africa. Appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The performance of the Rand last year was shaped by a mix of domestic and international factors, some predictable, others completely unexpected. From the outcomes of South Africa's election to global inflation trends, commodity price fluctuations, and even a reprieve from load shedding, the currency had a volatile but, I guess, a fascinating year. So what lies in store? Let's make some sense of those events and what kind of context they provide for all of us as we head into the new year. I'm joined by Harry Schertzer, Chief Executive Officer, Future Forex, a fintech specializing in international money transfers. Harry, thank you. A very warm welcome to you. So let's look back, first of all, to 2024. What were some of the more surprising trends as far as the Rand was concerned in your view? What alarmed you?
Hi, Jeremy. Yeah, great to be on again, and thanks again for having me on. Yeah, no, it was a remarkable year for the Rand in both directions. It was hugely volatile. There were so many events that happened that ended up moving the Rand in one direction or another. What's quite interesting is by the end of the year, the Rand was in a very similar place to where it was on 1 January 2024. So it kind of bounced around and came back to a very similar place. But some of the things that were quite scary throughout the year and then ended up being somewhat avoided was, for example, the election in South Africa. When ANC got far less than 50% of the vote, there was a massive question as to who they would partner with. And there were fears amongst the market that that might have been with parties like MK or EFF who weren't particularly investor friendly, and that would have been something which would have made the Rand potentially plummet. But as it turned out, there were near escapes, and every time it looked like there might be an issue with the Rand, what ended up happening is the right thing happened as far as the market's concerned, and the rand sort of stabilized. And so the only thing I'd say I'm slightly surprised by is that the rand didn't strengthen over the year, because when we look at the events that happened, there was more good than bad that happened, certainly within our borders. And so my suspicion is that we're at a relatively weak rand right now relative to where it might be in a few weeks' time.
Harry, I did reference global inflation slightly. There's been a little bit more stabilization. It was a key factor during the course of last year. How did that directly affect the rand, particularly during the interest rate cuts in September, and perhaps more importantly, as we look forward to 2025, how much of a factor is that going to be?
Yeah, so like I said, a lot went right in 2024, and this was an example of one of them, Jeremy, one of the things that went right, which is that with inflation being kept under control after it went wild during COVID, with it being kept under control, it allowed the US and South Africa to cut interest rates, because with inflation under control, it allows us the luxury of cutting interest rates. And in general, when interest rates are cut, it's a good thing for emerging market currencies like the rand. And so the rand strengthened in September when the US cut their interest rates by 50 bips, and South Africa followed suit and cut their interest rates by 25 bips. But in both cases, interest rates went down, which means there's more money floating around. And with more money floating around, more can be invested in emerging market currencies like the rand. So that was definitely another thing that went well for the rand during 2024.
As well as fluctuations in global commodity prices.
Exactly. Commodities, gold was at an all-time high for a lot of 2024. And with gold doing well and us being a major exporter of gold amongst other commodities, it's another thing that's good for the rand. So as you can see, there was a lot that went right for the rand in 2024. And my only concern and only surprise, you asked initially, what is my surprise for 2024? I'd say it's that the rand isn't stronger now than it was at the start of last year. And there are reasons for that, but I believe that we are in a little bit of a deflated rand, and the rand should strengthen in the coming weeks.
Harry, we know that load shedding improved significantly last year, and that did have a positive impact in terms of sentiment. But coming over the horizon is now the whole issue around water, particularly here in Johannesburg. Again, something that is going to have an impact on sentiment, surely.
Yeah, absolutely. As one problem gets resolved, another comes out. But I'd say that the water issue, while it is a very pressing issue, it's not as pressing for the economy as load shedding was. When you look at load shedding, it shut down businesses, it shut down corporates, it shut down shopping centers, etc. It basically meant that our GDP was directly impacted by no electricity. So that was the one, that's the big whale of an issue, which was made right. We've had over 250 days consecutively of no load shedding. So Eskom has finally pulled it together. And if they continue on that trajectory in 2025, I suspect that that coming right more than offsets the future issues, for example, the water issue right now in Joburg.
So that's a snapshot of what happened last year. And the key word there, I guess, is volatility. How does that help in predicting the currency's performance this year, or is it still a foolish person that's going to do that?
I mean, you only need to take last year's performance to realize how difficult it is to predict the rand. There were estimates early on that we'd go as, I guess, low as 21 to the dollar. You know, people were saying the rand's going to fall apart. And that might have happened if different things have happened in our local election, different things have had happened abroad, and inflation rates were different. But as we saw, actually, the rand held its own in 2024. So it is tough to predict. My suspicion is that we have a slightly weaker rand than it should be, and I suspect that the rand will strengthen in 2024. But obviously, there's no guarantee that that is the case. And so what I recommend to your listeners and pretty much every South African with savings is to ensure that you diversify your portfolio to ensure that you have not only South Africa-centric assets. Because the truth is, while we hope that the rand strengthens, and I suspect it will, there's no guarantee whatsoever. It's a foolish person to say the rand will definitely improve in 2025. And so the way to mitigate against this is by holding some international assets, be that stocks, be that just putting your money into dollars or euros, or pounds. But I think holding 100% of your asset base in rands presents risks which can be sort of mitigated away. And that's what I would say people should do who have the luxury of having.
So that's the clear mitigation strategy as far as that's concerned. And just very quickly then, is there anything that you're looking out for in this year and perhaps Q1 2025 that might shape the Rand's performance going forward?
I think the big elephant in the room is Donald Trump. Not that he looks like an elephant, although just that talking about him is what's going to shape the Rand, quite frankly. He's probably the most powerful man in the world, and he's very aggressive on his policies. We've seen that. So if he is favorable towards South Africa and towards our relationship with America, that'll be good for the Rand. However, if he continues the America first way of thinking, but hones in on that in a way where we've seen he's already targeted the BRICS nations quite severely and gone against a lot of their policies. If he continues to almost make South Africa into an enemy, that could be bad for the Rand. And in my view, that fear is one of the reasons that the Rand, in my view, is weaker than it should be. And I think when push comes to shove, if we can align with America as we have done in the past, the Rand will strengthen as a result. So that's what I'm looking out for are the tweets that Donald Trump makes and how that affects South Africa.
And I have heard him called worse than an elephant, Harry. Thank you very much for joining us. I have no doubt we'll talk again in the near future. Harry Schertzer, Chief Executive Officer of Future Forex.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The latest Absa Purchasing Managers Index for December last year is out and highlights ongoing challenges from weaker demand to logistical disruptions. But I also think there's a glimmer of optimism for this year. So let's break it all down with Sello Sekele, an economist at Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Sello, a very warm welcome to you. Let's start with that headline number, PMI dropping to 46.2 in December. What does this signify then for South Africa's manufacturing sector?
Thanks for having me, Jeremy. So basically, it says that business conditions in the manufacturing sector continue to deteriorate. So any number that's below 50 just basically means that business conditions were tough in the sector.
Of more concern is business activity, and that fell to 40.3%. Remind us what business activity is in terms of the index, and what are the key factors behind this decline, and how concerned should we be?
Yeah, so business activity basically means output, right? So what you tend to see is that when business activity declines, new sales orders also decline because, output tends to follow demand. So those were the main key drivers this time around, and as often, those are the two sub-indices that tend to drive the headline numbers. And this is quite surprising, right? So if you think about, how the manufacturing sector is quite sensitive to things like electricity supply, that was quite stable in December, but you continue to see business activity, which is output, continue to decline. So maybe it shows that demand overall in the sector is quite weak, and especially if you look at external demand, that's quite weak.
Are we talking about business activity across all sectors within manufacturing, or are there some areas that are perhaps less vulnerable than others?
Yeah, so what we don't get is the breakdown in terms of sectors. So we only look at it at a headline level. So it's mostly sectors that are covered, yes.
Now, you also referenced logistical issues contributing to supplier delivery time. I think we know what the problems are, but just elaborate for us very quickly on what is causing these disruptions. And again, going forward, do you have any sign that there is maybe a turnaround here, some degree of optimism?
So, yeah, so we reference, supply chain issues, because normally when you see business activity and new sales orders being weak, you tend to see supplier delivery times also getting less and less. But this time around, they lengthened. So what that says is that you have a supply chain that has some sort of blockages, even when activity is weak. So that's a sign that maybe there's some issues in terms of the supply chain. Now, I saw an article that says that there are issues in terms of the Pier 2 container terminal of Transnet. So maybe those are some of the issues that are contributing here. But look, Transnet is implementing its recovery plan. We know that that will take time. So for me, that's some glimmer of hope. So as time goes, I think the logistical issues in SA should get better.
And Sela, another glimmer of hope, a noted improvement in business optimism for the next 6 months. So obviously, they're taking the community is taking reports like that and drawing a similar conclusion.
Yeah, look, so here I just want to say, let's take it with a bit of a pinch of salt because the index is not seasonal adjusted. So what we tend to see here is that businesses tend to be quite optimistic at the end of each year, right? So I guess it's with a hope that the next coming year will be better. But with that said, I think, you know, there is a degree of optimism or of positivity we can take from this.
Another sign of positivity, but again, we've got to be very careful about this, I imagine, is that cost pressure is moderating. But we do have a weakening rand at the moment, and fuel prices are continually fluctuating. So, again, we need to be cautious there.
Yeah, we need to be cautious. Look, The external environment right now is not quite conducive for SA. That's why you see the rand, you know, being quite weak. But our baseline is that the rand will appreciate next year and end the year a bit stronger. So with that, we expect to see, you know, cost pressures relatively contained, well, this year rather.
Aside, we're all talking about 2024 and 25 in the same sentence these days. Aside from the logistics side and fixing Transnet, is there any recommendation on specific policy or infrastructure intervention that could help stabilize and support the sector in the near term beyond what is being done already?
Yeah, so look, Jeremy, every business operates at a local municipal level, right? And we know that municipalities, you know, most of them have issues, and manufacturers have continued, you know, to highlight this as a constraint. So when you start to see municipalities get their house in order, right, appoint engineers that they're supposed to appoint financial managers to run those municipalities efficiently and invest, you know, where they're supposed to invest, those kind of things are going to support not just the manufacturing sector but the economy as a whole.
And just a final question then, looking ahead to Q1 in 2025, let's get that date right, how do you see the manufacturing sector performing?
Yeah, so we are quite positive about not just the sector, but, you know, economy-wide, not just in Q1 also, but the whole of 2025. We think that with you know, improved optimism economy-wide, the manufacturing sector will also benefit from this and should support the manufacturing sector, not just in Q1, but the whole of 2025.
And that is a useful early barometer as far as South Africa's economic performance is concerned, the ABSA Purchasing Managers Index. And my thanks to economist Sello Sekele. And that's also our program for today. We're back tomorrow with another 30 minutes of issues driving South African business, political and social issues. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.